Welcome to Nonprofit Expert, presented by Donor Perfect.
I'm Robbie Healy, and thank you for joining us for Nonprofit Expert, presented by Donor Perfect. This year, we're talking with experienced nonprofit professionals in our Career Insights series. And today, I'm so lucky to be speaking with Eileen Heisman. Eileen's had a very distinguished career, most recently retired as the CEO of the National Philanthropic Trust. And in her journey as a professional, she's had several interesting positions and many interesting experiences. And she's going to spend some time now talking with us about some of those and how that informs the way she thinks about the future of our sector. So Eileen, I'm absolutely thrilled to have you here this afternoon and to talk about what we think the future of our sector might look like. But before we dive into that, why don't you fill in a little bit more about the career you've had, the opportunities you've had, the places you've been?
Sure, thank you. It's great to be here. And when I first got into fundraising from the AFP side, you were one of the people I looked up to and knew, and people would talk about you all the time. So fast forward, but I don't know how many years, I don't want to even say. But
it's probably several decades.
Yeah, several decades. It's fun for me to be here as well. So I started out thinking I wanted to make the world a better place, right? That was my goal as a pretty young age, like way beyond before high school. I mean, I thought making the world a better place was a worthy goal. And nobody said to me, go into business, make a lot of money. But my parents said to me, just pick a job you really want to do. So this is really how I looked at job opportunities. I mean, this is pretty nerdy. We used to get the Sunday New York Times, and this is way before the internet. And I, in the back of the current events section, there was all this job listings, not business jobs, but nonprofit jobs. I don't know how they and why they segregated them. And so I used to read those job descriptions. I was probably in early high school with a really fine-tooth comb and thinking, okay, I want to do a job like that, or I want to do a job like that. And that's how I formed this idea of what I could do and what skills I would need. And that was when I didn't even know anything about the sector. My parents didn't work. My parents were both in healthcare. And so then fast forward being a freshman in college, and my freshman roommate is there. And I never met her before. We were total strangers. And this is very sexist, but I said to her, what does your dad do? Right? I'm embarrassed that I said that now, but at the time, that's what I said. And she said, he works for Prudential Life Insurance, and he gives away money for them. And I said, what? And he was the grant making, the CSR person for Prudential Life Insurance in Newark and their big corporate offices. And I said, I think I said something like, wow, you can get paid for that. Or I either said it or thought it. And then I ended up meeting her dad, who was quite a gentleman. And so you can see the seeds of this, yep. Right? You can see these. And my mother was really active in civic affairs and League of Women Voters. And my dad ran for school board. So they were both involved in the community. And my mother used to take me. There were some pretty poor kids in our neighborhood who were part of a Girl Scout troop my mother ran. And my mother used to take food over to them, and she always made me go with her to drop the food off. And then she would say not to talk about it to people because she didn't want them to be embarrassed that they were getting free food. So I go to college and get a bachelor's degree at Carnegie Mellon in psychology. And then I did a year working in a mental health inpatient in between. And then I went to graduate school at Michigan in social work. There was the thing called the macro. It was the micro, which was clinical work. And then there was macro, which is like organizational work inside the nonprofit sector. And I majored in social program evaluation at University of Michigan. And that really just put me in this career path, but I still didn't know about fundraising. But I was interested in politics, and I did an internship at Congressional Budget Office. And then I ended up getting a job working for Joan Spector in City Hall during her first term. And I loved politics. I just loved it. And I worked for Ireland too for a little while. But at the end of the 4 years, she was running for re-election. And we were the staff members in City Hall in Philadelphia who work in City Council are the only people allowed in the whole city government, allegedly, to get involved in political campaigns, because it's really hard to, when you're working in a councilperson's office, to delineate this is a campaign thing, this is a work, you know, so I was allowed to do political things there. And she asked me if I would help her do these fundraisers. And I said, yeah, sure. So, you know, I was putting these events together and charging and like being at the door and collecting money and getting remarks ready and all this stuff. So I did that. And at the end of the, and she won re-election. And at the end, she said, you know, you're really good at this. You should think about doing this professionally. And you know what my answer was? Good at what?
That's
what,
funny.
I literally, like, what are you talking about? And she said, fundraising, you know, people get paid for it. I said, they do?
The power of a mentor.
And she said, yeah. She said, you should really think about it. And then I left her office, and she kept in touch with me. And I was having a hard time getting a job. I actually couldn't find a job. And somebody said that I should consider professional fundraising, charitable fundraising, relative to political fundraising. So I did a bunch of informational interviews, and I ended up putting my, you know, rearranging my resume, which at the time I typed on an old-fashioned typewriter.
Didn't we all?
And I started interviewing, and I interviewed it. I got a job offer at Drexel, and I didn't, the person who was running Drexel Development then, nobody really liked her, so I wanted to work for people that I liked. And I ended up doing 7 interviews and got my first charitable job at the Philadelphia Foundation. I was their first development officer. It was 1987, and they had never had anybody raise money before.
1987, interesting. You would think.
And so, and community foundations were, and still have to raise money to keep their public right. support test for being public charities. And so I didn't know what that even meant at the time, but now, but then I started working there, and I had been working in campaigns for about 2.5 years, political campaigns. And she, and I couldn't believe how boring I thought it was. There I was, you know, it's endowment money, it's long-term, and it was bequest money waiting for people to die. I mean, getting them in the will. I'm like, oh my gosh. And I, you know, I was used to this incredible fast pace. And it was the opposite. And I thought, I can't stand this. And I was calling my political friends up saying, you got to get me out of here. I can't stand it. And then a check came in. One check came in for $650,000 that I'd never seen a check, because at that point, the max you'd give to a political candidate, a Senate, was $10,000. So I missed something. I became the finance director of Arlen's 86 re-election campaign to the U.S. Senate. So I went for Joan Lennon and went to Arlen. And so that was a national job. That was, and that's when I couldn't find work after that. That was pretty scary. And so the Philadelphia Foundation took a chance on me, and I went in there and then didn't like it, and then got this check for $650. And then I was like, oh my gosh. And then I thought, wow, this is a lot of money. And then literally overnight, I went from, I can't stand it, to, I'm going to figure out how this check got here. And I'm going to figure out the path that it took and everything, every behavior step I could track. And then I'm going to figure out how to do it and do it really well. And that was like, you know, one thing happens and I was like, okay. And I went, came to work the next day instead of like whining and like really fetching and like, just, I was like, I was ready to rock and roll. So I went on this path. I started interviewing, I talked to a lot of people, but I said, what are the 10 fastest growing community foundations? And they told me, and this is before Zoom, wave, you know, I make phone calls, introduce myself, had to get through their secretaries or some administrative assistants. And I interviewed the people who were raising money from the 10 fastest growing community foundations in the country. And I collected all this data and I put it together and I created a plan for the Philadelphia Foundation. And it was all based on data, right? It was a data-driven plan. It was 87 to 92 is when I was there. And I just got started. I mean, I got started doing it. And it's actually that plan that when I went to NPT, I made into a national plan. Like I just pulled out my plan.
The fundamentals were the fundamentals.
Exactly. But in the interim, I realized that I became a mother, and I also realized that I needed to hone some more fundraising skills, because being a political fundraiser was good for sort of annual giving. But and so I ended up, and I liked planned giving a lot. So I worked at the Philadelphia Foundation for almost 5 years, and then became director of planned giving at Einstein, and then moved to Abington shortly after, where I was director of planned giving, then director of development under Nick Costa, we were just talking about Nick, and worked with Beverly Goldberg, who's a rock star. And I ended up sort of learning the tools of the trade at a really hands-on development office at a hospital that had a huge donor base and very loyal donor base. And I learned about recognition there. I learned about stewardship there. Beverly was a great teacher. And Nick was very by the book. He was actually writing a book at the time. And so I got to be a student of these incredible craftsmen who were right around me. And it was really fun. I mean, and I'm like a spongy learner, but all of a sudden the world seemed small. Like there I was in this 10-mile radius. You know, it's like this is not all there is to life. And I had just been working. Arlen's campaign was national, really. Even though it was Pennsylvania campaign, the fundraising was national. And so I heard through the grapevine that Pitcairn Trust Company was starting this entity called the National Philanthropic Trust. And I thought, wow, it'd be cool to do this nationally. Like, that would really be cool. And it's near my house. And I had this whole thing. And so I made a cold call, kind of. And I, it was not completely cold, but it was pretty
lukewarm.
Cold. Yeah.
Lukewarm call.
It wasn't a hot. It was like, I had one intro to them, right? It wasn't like I called out of nowhere. And they said, come in. And then they talked to me. And I talked about, you know, all the things I just said to you. And they offered me a job. And then I said, they didn't have a job description. So they gave me this job description. It was for like a private banker type, like a relationship manager for a private bank. And I came back and I said, I don't think this is really what you want me to do. Like, this isn't really the job. It's like a banking job. And they said, okay, you write it. So I said, okay. So that was in 96. And then for 2 years, and then they gave me a promotion within those 2 years. And then this person who was president stepped down. It was a family member who I loved and ended up going on the board. And that he went on the board. And then they promoted me to be CEO. And that was in 98. And I raised the first, you know, $1 million gift within a couple months. And then I took my plan from Philadelphia Foundation with all these fundamentals. And I said, okay, it's not going to be the region anymore. It's going to be national. And I scoped out what that meant. And I just started on my way. And when I left after being CEO for 26 years, we had about $42 billion in the bank. We had raised $63 billion in aggregate. We had given away about $30 billion in aggregate. And at one point, really not the year I left, but the year before that, we'd become the third largest grant maker in the world. And I always would say, you can't give it away unless you raise it. And so I was always in there with my fundraising lens on, always. I mean, I never was a great grant maker. I never liked the grant making side. And most donor advised funds, donors don't need grant or want grant making support. So I was really looking through that lens. And so I never looked back after that. And that $650,000 check at the Philadelphia Foundation was like this pivotal moment. And I remember, like, you know, when you remember those moments in your life, you remember.
Absolutely.
I was standing near the front desk that had a high counter, and I'm pretty short, so the counter was pretty high. And I remember opening the check, and because it was so big, but I had only been there for a few months, because I was a development person, I could get credit for it. Though it was a bequest that had been left years before by a woman from Fidelity Bank. I actually got the whole story. Called the trust department, said, you know, we just got this check. Could you tell me how it got here?
But you're talking about relationships over decades.
Yes.
From the little girl reading the New York Times job postings to a college roommate whose dad winds up being an instrumental mentor, even if organic.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly.
When she would hear his daughter, my roommate, used to talk about what her dad did. She would talk about it. I said, that's really interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think, I don't know about you, but when I was in high school, I had my career path planned.
You did?
Oh, absolutely.
What was it?
I was going to work for the Girl Scouts. So I wrote to the Girl Scouts of the USA and I said, if I'm going to get hired by a Girl Scout council after I graduate from college, what should I major in?
Well, that's working backwards.
And
I do that
said,
a lot.
They said, be a teacher. And I'm like, I don't want to be a teacher.
But that's one of those careers that women were always getting pigeonholed.
Well, it was before Title IX.
Right.
And it was before women who had children kept their jobs, which I realize was very controversial at the time. But anyway.
And had summers off and were off, you know.
All the things.
Yeah, two or three.
So
three
I talk. Tripped across. I was a counselor at a Girl Scout camp in the summer. And in the CIT, the Counselor Training Program. And one of the staff was doing an undergraduate degree in recreation and outdoor education at Indiana University. And I'm like, that sounds like me. So I actually did an undergraduate degree at Northeastern in recreation therapy and outdoor education and fully intended to work for the Girl Scouts forever. And after 6 years of working in one Girl Scout council, I decided the woman in the council next to me needed to be my mentor. And before she realized she'd been tapped for this high honor, I said, I'm going to apply for every job she posts until she hires me. And the first one she did was a director of fund development.
And she hired you.
And she hired me. She said at the end of her search, she had a Girl Scout who'd never raised a dollar and a hospital fundraiser who knew everybody in town but had never been a Girl Scout. And she thought it was easier to teach fundraising skills than the culture of Girl Scouting. And the late Hank Rosso was still alive.
Yes.
And I went to his fundraising school, and that was the
So she put mission over experience.
Mission over skills.
That's really interesting.
Well, and I think that's probably pretty smart.
Well, because you probably stay longer, right? Because you're already demonstrated that you're in love with the mission, right? You lived it. You wanted to work there. And yep. She didn't know. When did you tell her that you were going to apply for every job? Did you ever tell her that?
I don't know. I don't know if I did.
That's something I would wait like 3 years to tell somebody.
I don't know that. And it's a long and boring story, but I only worked for her about 2 years till I wound up moving here. And when this chapter, the Philadelphia AFP chapter, named me Fundraising Executive of the Year, I happened to be in Rochester, New York. This was up in Syracuse, Geneva, actually. I told her I was coming, and I brought the National Philanthropy Day program with my picture in it and took it to her and said, look what you started. And she said, I knew you would be good at that.
That's so great. I don't know what you're got it.
But that's like yeah. Joan Spector.
Yeah, she, and you know what? She kept in touch with me until she died recently. Like we would have dinner. She had dementia at the end, so it was harder to have dinner with her because she wasn't quite all there anymore. But she said, Elaine, I know you're doing really well. I mean, she would always, and I thought, you know, this whole thing, you're good at it. I'm like, good at what? Like, I'll never forget that conversation because yep. I didn't know what the what was because I said there's not much to it, which is such a bizarre thing. But I mean, the political fundraising piece for city council, it was a pretty limited little box of things that I, you know, toolbox that I just used over and over again. But I was disciplined and I like to get things over the finish line and I'm competitive with myself. So if I raise a certain amount, I should get more. And follow up, I'm good at follow up, like all the stuff that makes fundraisers good. And it's not like I had to teach myself, I'm just that way naturally.
But I think that's what's different now about decades ago. There wasn't a glide path. And now when you look at people coming into the sector intentionally, if you look back on the pivotal moments, not necessarily in your career personally, but in the sector,
right.
When you think about what the next 10 years, the next 20 years, the next 30 years, because I think you're a generative thinker. I mean, you want to be excellent today, but what's tomorrow going to bring? And how does tomorrow stay excellent while you keep today going? What do you think shaping?
I call that sitting on top of the mountain, standing and looking over. Like because I think if you're a CEO and you're good, you have to be worried about the day to day, but you have to get on top of the
absolutely.
Mountain.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So what would you...
So, you know, I have the great privilege of teaching a philanthropy and fundraising course at Penn, a graduate course. I cold called the dean 20 years ago, and he didn't call me back, and I called him two more times. I called him three times, and he finally called me back. And I was CEO of NPT at the time, but we were so small. You know, that was a great title of, like, a very tiny thing, but... He finally talked, and I went down, I ate lunch with him, and the dean at Penn, of the School of Social Policy and Practice, and he said, why are you chasing me around? I'm like, well, because I have this idea. And I said to him, you know, it took me about 12 years to put all the facts and figures and kind of constructs together about how money goes from individuals, you know, and foundations and corporations into the nonprofit sector and as a fundraiser. And that framework is... Like, it took me a long time, but I said, what I'd like to do is take what I learned and distill it into a course and teach it to people that are going into the sector so they can do it smarter, faster, better, and easier than it took me 12 years to kind of, what's this world I'm working on? And he looked at me, and I said, you know, I was talking at Temple. I have somebody at Temple, but I'd rather do it here. He goes, don't go to Temple. I'm like, okay. and he said, you're hired. And I said, really? And he goes, yeah, but it's going to take you a while to get into the classroom. And he said, because you have to have a full 14-week syllabus, you have to have every reading, you have to have every class, all the 14 weeks mapped out, and you have to have a grading rubric, you know, everything. And he said, you don't just walk in. And I said, okay. And you know what I did? I took my AFP outline for the orientation course that they used to teach at Villanova. I took that and I kind of mushed it around and made it my own. It had all the fundamentals. I literally took that. I took it out and that was my framework for, and my course. That was the framework that I used. And, you know, that was over 20 years ago. But, and I never teach the same thing twice, but the benefit of that class, and I have about 600 former students all over the country, even the world, many of whom, I'd say 80% work in development. And a lot of them come in saying, I don't really like this stuff, but I feel like I should know what I want to work. I mean, they come in sort of whiny. And I just ignored that. Like I said, okay, well, you know, first class, I make everybody go around and tell me what they want to learn, you know, because I kind of want to know everybody's baseline. And by the end, almost inevitably, from whatever they said at that first class, they come, you know what, I know I was sounding negative at the beginning, but this is really interesting. You make it really interesting. So, but the other benefit of that course is that I get to see the next generation of young people who are going to be taking all of our jobs and going to be doing this radio show podcast instead of us, right? They're going to say, oh, I remember those two women, right? But, and you know what? We're going to be in really good hands.
So what do you see from the top of the mountain?
I think that the sector, well, right now, at this moment in time, because of all the federal cutbacks and decisions that are getting made, I think we're in an unusual crisis spot. So I'm going to put that in the parking lot for a second because that's relatively recent. But I think the sector is going to grow and thrive. I think they're, you know, they have the mission-driven pieces are the same, but the tools that they have are really, really different, I think, to fundraise and to also, you know, execute, right? Just artificial intelligence alone, right, is an amazing tool that, like, unimaginable. Even 10 years ago. And they're committed to mission-driven organizations. They know they're not going to make as much money. They want to exercise their ability to make the world a better place. They often come with years of experience. There are very few of the people who get this graduate degree, it's nonprofit leadership, are right out of college. And they're really committed to being excellent. And so I'm very confident that we're going to be in good shape. I think from a policy point of view right now, you know, we're watching some deconstruction going on, and we're going to have to work really hard to reconstruct when this place where we are ends or comes to a kind of a saner moment in time. So it's a scary time right now. I mean, I was CEO for 26 years. I have to say I'm still teaching. I'm doing some consulting and I'm writing a book. And when I'm watching what's going on, and I watch it pretty closely, I still have my subscription to the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I talk to people like you, and I have an inside the Beltway lobbyist who I talk to a lot, and I'm teaching, right? So you have to stay current when you're teaching. But I think that we're going to be in a maintenance shrinking mode for a little while. And it's just sad. It's heartbreaking, actually, to me personally and professionally. But I think for when it comes to personnel and talent, hugely talented people are coming through my class. And, you know, LaSalle has a nonprofit leadership program.
I teach the course at Villanova.
You teach the course at Villanova. You know, Gratz College has a fundraising track for their, like, nonprofit. And, you know, of course, Indiana's there. I mean, so there's a lot more academic interest in the nonprofit sector. You and I learned through the seat of my pants, right?
Yep.
There was nothing. There was hardly any formula. AFP, right? And the plan giving.
That's right. Yeah.
Right.
That's where you learned.
And I used to go to every AFP lunch and breakfast. I never missed a Franklin Forum because.
No, you couldn't.
Yeah. And I went to the New York Fundraising Day often because if I didn't learn that way, I wasn't learning. And the Chronicle of Philanthropy barely existed, or Nonprofit Times when I was first starting. So there was no body of knowledge. I think there's a body of knowledge now. You know, and so I worry about people that just lean into the sector without learning anything.
Yeah, I think I've thought about at least 30 different lines of conversation we could have. But it's interesting to me, I think about 2009, when the mortgage banking crisis and the economic downturn. And of course, that was not a political crisis as much, well, tangentially it certainly
was.
But but it was an economic crisis and people would be crying out, the nonprofit sector needs to step in. Well, and of course we'd been there the whole time, but when the need was less obvious to folks, there was no hue and cry. And I'm expecting that now, that with people struggling and healthcare being diminished or food resources being diminished or services for people experiencing homelessness, the hue and cry will come back. The nonprofit sector needs to do something. And of course, it's such a double-edged sword because the reason for the crisis is reduced money and the impact on jobs. And it's just this vicious cycle. And I hope you're right. I believe you're right that it'll be somewhat temporary and we will get through it. But the recovery will be painful.
And we're probably going to lose some talented people in the sector who are not going to want to endure it. But, you know, the burnout, I think the burnout in the sector, and especially fundraisers, but when you're in a crisis, you know, when you don't have to do your job every day or you think you can do something else, you know, at some point you might say, I don't want to do this anymore. I never got to that point. And I went through the downturn in, you know, 99 to like right around 2000, that first internet kind of explosion, mm-hmm. where these companies that didn't have a real product or service had these high valuations and then they tanked and a lot of things blew up. And then that 08, 09 with the mortgage crisis. Yeah. You know, and then there was around COVID, you know.
Absolutely.
Yep. And then here we are now. Now is less, I mean, the market's so volatile right now. I mean, it's just watching. You know, I have to say, I've always been a fan of the business world. I never was thinking, oh, these are the bad guys. And so I watched the business world because I knew they were our donors. And I, you know, and when I end my class, I always say, are you watching the business? Like, are you reading the business section of the, you know, people reading digitally now, the paper, right? And a lot of them say no, almost like I'm interested in the nonprofit sector. Like that's not, I said,
that's
yeah,
not my,
time out.
Yes,
yeah,
yes,
time
it
out.
Is.
It is a part of your world, right? Yeah. It is. The economy dictates a lot of things that cascade into the nonprofit sector. And I think it takes a certain kind of thinker to think that. But when you talked about being on the mountain, I think we have to hunker down. We're probably going to be expected to do more with less, which is kind of ridiculous. I mean,
but it's the constant you and cry for us.
I mean, that, you know what? I've been in this business since my first charitable giving job since 87. I mean, I've heard that since 87. And it's 2025, right?
And it's the never any overhead, only program focus, never any R&D, only guaranteed success, all the things that on the business side of the table would never be a thing ever.
The demonization of overhead by the original Charity Navigator leadership was one of the worst things that's happened in this sector in 30 years, because strategic planning, having good equipment,
branding.
And research and development, like, and program evaluation and all these things that you need to figure out how to run, you know, management training, having bench strength. All those things that the for-profit sector take for granted, especially the big, they're demonized and all that. And when people say overhead, you know, I said, wouldn't it be great to have a strategic plan? I try to kind of break it down what overhead means. And when you break it down, people don't push back as much. But
no,
this overhead has just become this, like, a terrible word. Oh, my gosh. And you know what? Even though Charity Navigator has changed its tune, when I would talk to donors at NPT, and they were when I was so close to them, as we got bigger, I got farther away, but they would say, well, I don't want to give to overhead. That was a hue and cry.
Yeah, there was a 100 Women Who Care group in Chester County a few years ago that I was active in before COVID. And in their model, the way they did it, any member of 100 Women Who Care could bring a nonprofit to present themselves to be one of the ones you'd consider that night. And one person, you could count, you could set your watch to her raising her hand first and asking each person, what's your overhead percentage? And I wanted to take her aside and say, do you have any idea what you're actually asking?
Don't plan. Don't train your staff.
Don't plan. Don't supervise well. Don't provide them good infrastructure. Don't provide them good tools. Don't provide them good equipment. Don't allow them to get training.
Don't do program evaluation, but do a really good job and have the data that you need,
yeah,
right?
All the things. So I had a chance to talk to Art Taylor when we were developing this series, and he had an interesting comment about future professionals for the sector.
What did he say?
Well, he talked about the people in government who are either being terminated or opting out, and that he believes they could be a pool of very interested, committed individuals who might find a home in the nonprofit sector. Because in his experience, many of them went into government with the same motivation, to do public service, but on the government side, not the nonprofit side. Is he right?
I mean, probably partially right. I mean, whenever there's a, you know, outflow of a bunch of people, and that's really been a tragic one, right? Fired without cause.
It certainly has been.
If there is, you know, if there are people who want to do that, do I think it's an easy transition? Probably easier than other places, but I think there's still a body of knowledge and a culture of the sector that's probably different than the government. But I mean, they are working to make the world a better place. I guess it depends on what department and what they're like and, you know, what their skill set is like. I mean, the thing that's amazing to me, and you probably remember this, is that when we were younger, fundraising jobs, like getting your first fundraising job was pretty easy, right?
Well, that's because people thought anybody could raise money.
Right. And so now, though, it's actually really hard. And I'm saying that relative to these government folks because, you know, getting your foot in the door, you have to demonstrate competence. You have to demonstrate that you're aligned with a mission, that you have the skill set to do the job. Do I think it's a pool of people? Yeah. I mean, do I think they could jump right in? Some probably could, but I think a lot of them, it'd be a culture shock, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting when you think about the, I don't know about you, but people I know who are looking for development officers can't find them because they're jobs and people who apply, but not qualified people who apply.
Right.
So I think that's another big piece. Earlier, you mentioned artificial intelligence. I'd love to circle back to that.
Yes.
As I think, I just finished co-chairing the task force that rewrote the AFP Code of Ethics. And as we've been doing the rollout.
It's so great that you do that work.
Oh, it was.
Are you still on the board, the national board?
Oh, no. I finished that in 2010.
Wow. Okay.
So it's been a while.
But I feel like you're still there, right?
Well, when they ask me to do something I feel I can help with, I say yes.
That's great.
But I honestly think this Code of Ethics project is probably my last big one because I think there's so many other talented people who need a chance. I just want to get out of the way.
Yeah.
But the last piece of the launch of the new code was in Seattle at the International Conference. And every time I've done a national presentation or regional presentation, the number one question I get asked is, what's the standard on AI? And I say there is none because there are no standards on tactics. There are two standards that apply. One is don't overinflate your skills. And the other one is don't steal intellectual property. So those fit together. But if we think of AI as a tool, and I know some people are worried that it's going to replace human beings doing work. And other people think it's some kind of mystical evil thing. And some people think it is the biggest solution to every problem we've ever had. How do you see it fitting into our work?
You know, so in my class, it's been an issue for a couple of years. And my first year that it started to come, you know, when somebody speaks English as a second language and they submit a paper three times longer than it has to be in perfect English that sort of sounds robotic almost. I'm like, this person didn't write this. And I've had foreign students for almost the whole 19 years. So I'm used to slightly awkwardly written English. And it's like, and all of a sudden, I mean, it was like, what? I didn't know what to do, right? And so I called, and Penn was really at that point still kind of formulating their thoughts about it. They're much more sophisticated now. But I think it's a tool, but it's not the end result. And, you know, somebody, I joined this group of people called Life 50 of former chiefs who are now in retirement age, but still really active and healthy. And I just went to a meeting in Miami with them. And it's been one of the most fun things I've done since I've stepped away from my job. And they were talking about AI a lot. In fact, it was a huge topic. And they were talking about having it be a first draft. I think this is a great metaphor. You know, if you have a really complicated email on a topic, you can have it do a first draft of something, but you should never send that draft out. You should, like, you use it as an outline. And so I think when you come to think of it that way, because it might be pulling from inaccurate data, or it might not be your point of view, or it certainly may not be in your voice, but it may give you a framework that would help you from your own sense of what a first draft might look like. And so in that sense, it could save you a lot of time. I use it when I'm not sure about something, and I think I know a fact that I heard somewhere, but I'm not positive. I'll use it and say, could you tell me the fact about this or that? And it'll come back. And then based on that, I might ask it a second or third question. And then I would go out and do my original research and, like, just use that as, like, a tool. I think if that's the only tool that you're using and you're not putting any of your personal intelligence or thoughtfulness or other research, it's terrible. I think you should use it like you would use the encyclopedia or I remember Wikipedia when it came out. Yep. People thought it was terrible. And I actually have in my own syllabuses, you cannot use Wikipedia as a source because it's all secondhand information, right? And so that seems like a little drop in the bucket now relative, because Wikipedia couldn't write it for you. But, you know, this idea about writing a paper, one of my assignments is writing a direct mail piece. And they have to pick something that they have either a place that they've identified or a place where they've worked or have been a donor to. And they said, well, that's a pretty AI proof, assignment. Then I thought to myself, well, you could ask the AI to write a direct mail piece, right?
Why not?
Yeah. And so it's going to be our generation and everybody's struggling with this. I mean, I'm also involved at Carnegie Mellon, where I went to undergrad. And when I had this pen problem, I went to this committee, this national committee that I'm on, and the dean's there of the school where I graduated from at CMU. And I said, can I talk to you about your policy on artificial intelligence? I mean, and I told him my struggles, and they were struggling about the exact same thing. And so the whole world's struggling about it. And I think, like the internet, when we thought it was going to, we didn't know what the internet was going to be 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. It was, and you didn't know how it was going to be used. I think we're right at the beginning, scary point. But I think we're going to need to incorporate it in and figure it out. And I actually enjoy. At first, I thought it was horrible to use it. I actually enjoy using it, but I'm careful about what I use it for. I was just at this session where they were doing a teaching thing about it. And the guy who was teaching it said, you can teach it how to talk in your voice. So they can give you something. You say, I don't think that's accurate. I want it to be more similar to other things I've done. And so the guy said, you have to be bossy. You have to, like, push it around. And he had this whole strategy about, like, being the boss of the AI tool that you're using. And don't let, and don't ever take the first response, like, to be the final thing. Like, you got to form, And so the way it works now, 5 years from now, it'll probably be way more sophisticated.
2 years from now, it may be.
Yeah, right. My brother, who is a chess master and lives in a different intellectual world than I've lived in, he thinks that it's going to become smarter than people and faster thinking than people. And that there's a whole group of kind of people that are terrified of it. And he sort of lives in that world. So I know when I see him, not to talk to him too much because he makes me really nervous, even though I love him and he's my brother, because he tells you why. He tells me why. He's not just being a sensationalist kind of Chicken Little, the sky is falling. And I said, yeah, Danny, I know that sounds like it really could happen. I mean, what I was supposed to say is that he's actually making sense, but I kind of refused.
Don't you remember when Google searches were first a thing? And you could search for anything and you could get all this stuff. And
you still had to organize it, right?
Of course you did. And you had to filter out what was true, what was false. And you'd go to the library into the reference section to research whether what you got from Google was right. I mean, we remember card catalogs and doing your own research.
Yes.
In my opinion, AI is no different than, the 10-cent photocopy machine in the library where you'd copy a page and take it back to your office and use that. It's just faster.
Right.
And it aggregates a lot more stuff.
So you need to make sure that you need to check, right? You need to do some
check. Absolutely need to. And I think you also need to decide how you are going to allow it to be used in your own work.
Yes.
As an agency, not just as an individual.
At Penn, it's professor by professor.
Interesting.
they have some general policies, but it's up to you to figure out, because the what gets taught is so broad at Penn. They felt like they couldn't make rules that would fit every class and what the tasks are related. Think of a physics class or my fundraising or, yeah. or what Wharton's teaching, I mean, or English literature, right? You to make a policy that fits all those classes doesn't, they just decided not to do it, but they have workshops at the Wazoo. In fact, tomorrow I'm taking probably my sixth Penn workshop on use of AI in the classroom.
You've talked a lot about the body of knowledge and the impact that the present body of knowledge has on people starting their careers or early in their careers. When you think about skills and leadership qualities for people who are going to be in these chairs 40 years from now, what skills do they need? And what leadership qualities do you see as the most useful?
It's one of my former board chairs said to me, and then she said it publicly, she said, Eileen, you're an EQ CEO. And I said, what does that mean? And she said, you don't live by the numbers, so you know the numbers. You live in the emotional intelligence of managing. She says, because you know you have somebody who knows the numbers right next to you, which was true. Before I became a CEO, I thought, if I ever become one, I'm going to need a really good finance director or VP for finance or CFO, because I just don't go there right away. But I like it. I like looking at the budget, but I don't put the budget together. And so I think that CEOs need the emotional intelligence of understanding what motivates people to go to the office every day, you know, how tasks get assigned relative to a strategic plan, how to articulate a strategic work, you know, how to motivate people, how to respond to a board. Like, you know, working with the board is a huge part of my job, and if you're going to be in a chief role, you know, you have to deal with the board. The board are business people that have different stakes in the ground, that come from all different disciplines, who maybe never, ever worked at a nonprofit, and then all of a sudden they're basically supervising you, right? So you have to really be cognizant of that. I was always trying to see the world through their eyes, each of their eyes, right? Not their collective eyes. And then you have to be a jack of all trades. I mean, I had to know about technology. So I think you have to need to know at least a little bit about everything that's going on in your organization. And so you have to have a wide breadth of knowledge. You have to be really attuned to people. You have to understand what motivates people. You have to be able to read and understand a budget and or work with it when it's not working. And then you have all these external things. So I mean, you have to have eyes in the back of your head. And you have to like that pace. And like, if you're somebody that's really rigid, that likes black and white, and I'm not done my task yet, so therefore I can't get to that, don't be a CEO, because you have, like, I would come with my list, and sometimes it was written, and sometimes it was in my head of what I was going to do in a day. And there were days that as soon as I got in, there were little fires to put out, a big thing had happened, somebody had decided to resign, or somebody else became pregnant, or somebody else was having a hard time with their families, or mental health issues, or, you know, and so I would come in with what I thought was going to happen that day, and many days.
At the end of the day, the list was still there.
The list was still there, and I had to make sure that the trains were running on time, even though my list wasn't getting done. So learning how to delegate, I learned a lot of it on the job, and I learned some of it by watching managers that I really, really liked. So when I worked at Abington Hospital, I thought the CEO was brilliant, a guy named Felix Pilla. I think he's recently died, but he had been a frontline nurse, and his mother was a immigrant from Italy. And he was this little Italian guy, and he sort of looked like a frog, brilliant guy. And because I was a fundraiser, I had access to him, even though I was many, many steps below him. And so I would see him, and he liked me, and I liked him. And I said to him once, I was there for about almost 5 years, I said, what is your management philosophy? Because the hospital was brilliantly run, really. I mean, it was clean. There were no clinical, like, people weren't suing. It was pretty amazing to work there. And he said, he goes, I believe by management, by walking around. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, I talk to the people that clean the floors. I talk to the people that are in the operating room. I talk to the people in the cafeteria. I talk to the doctors. I talk to the nurses. I go to the emergency room. So I go and I talk to people and I watch and I listen. He goes, I learned a ton that way. And then he said the other thing, and I'll never forget this, because this was really antithetical to how I thought about the world at that moment in time. He said, I let people who were good at their jobs and smart, I let them make mistakes and learn on their own, even if so they tell me what they're going to do. And I might not agree with it, but I let them. He goes, if somebody's going to die or be threatened by it, I don't. But he said, day-to-day management things, if I don't agree with them, instead of me dictating that, I need to be grooming them and growing them as managers. And he said, sometimes I'm wrong. And sometimes they just find another way to get there. But he said, and I let them learn from that. And it's really important to let that happen. I was at the age where I never thought about that. And so, and he said, and I paid my dues, He went up, you know, in different jobs. And one of the things, and so I paid my dues. I had all the incremental steps before I got to be a CEO. And it's been really interesting to watch the younger generation. Like when I use the phrase paying your dues, some of them get it. A lot of them don't get it. Or they think if they did one or two good things, they paid their dues. But sometimes the dues take a long time, you know. And so, to be a student and a sponge of people around you and to really be a good listener and to ask questions. And the other thing I learned really early on is never jump to make a conclusion based on one comment one person says, because there's often another side to the story.
Or 10.
Yeah, so collect a lot more information. And I had this temperature. I trust my intuition a lot, which I think intuition is a combination of experience, knowledge, previous things that have happened to you. I'm not sure it's like spiritual in nature, but if I was uncomfortable making a decision, especially a big one, and I could feel it, I would say, I guess I don't have enough information, and I would sleep on it. And something that would make me really angry the day before, a good night's sleep, I would get up in the morning and feel totally different with the same set of facts. And so I came to watch myself and knowing that I shouldn't be making this decision now. I need to calm down, or I need more information, or I need the other side of the story, or there's something here that doesn't feel right. And so I think all those things. Do you need to go to business school? Maybe. Can you learn it on your own? You can. But the EQ part, I think if you're not good at EQ, you can learn how to read people and read things. You have to work harder at it. You know, if you're a strict numbers person, you have to learn it. If you're like me, you have to, you know, and my accounting people, the people who's my CFO, especially as we got really big, would laugh at me and they'd say, I mean, you know way more than you think you know about accounting. But it took me, you know, it took me a long time. I had to figure it out. And I used to say at the beginning of the budget season, you know, treat me like a really smart 12th grader or, you know, senior in college, because I have a high ability to learn, but I just like, you know, go slower. Like you don't talk like you're talking to another person who has an accounting background. And eventually, you know, I knew what to read, but I still would make sure, like, am I really reading this right? You know, is this what it says to me? And I asked a million questions.
You're talking about admitting out loud what you don't know.
Yes, I always did.
Well, and I think that's something that we're trained never to do. So if you're going to be successful, you have to go against your training. Because I think that's one of the things that hold the sector back. I think especially with board members. But, you know, we don't want to be on a board with each other and come in a room and...
I agree with you. Board members have this thing where if you're just smarter... You would be working in the for-profit sector. So I always suffered the most when I felt this criticism was coming at me. Like, kind of like, not don't wear your pretty little head about it. So if you want to make me crazy, say that to me. But more...
I'd like to see the person who said that to you.
Oh, man, but more like, well, if you really had your act together and you're really smart, you would be working in the for-profit sector. And you're not, so you're working here instead. And I thought, you know what? Mission-driven work is sacred. I feel it's sacred. And I feel like charitable fundraising is sacred. And I feel like when somebody's making us responsible for the money that they've earned to put it to good use for a mission, like what a huge responsibility that is, and how morally difficult that is, and how seriously I took that. Every day I thought about that. And this idea that I'm not smart because of it, like, what does that mean, number one? And number two, how did you come to that conclusion?
Well, exactly. Did you figure that out?
No.
We'll work on that.
An arrogance. You know, I heard a guy from who had worked at Bain that started, what's the spinoff from Bain that was the nonprofit consulting firm? Anyway, so he said, this is really interesting. I went to a Stanford Executives in Philanthropy program. He said the difference between your for-profit salary and your nonprofit salary for the exact same job is an exact measure. That delta is a measure of the emotional satisfaction you get from doing that work. So you could be making that much more, but you're choosing not to because there's something inside of you that makes you want to do this work about the world. And I heard that. That was probably 18 or 19 years ago. I went to that program. And that has stuck with me because I could have gone into the... I actually had one job in the for-profit sector, and I felt like I had my wrong size clothes on every day. But I thought, you know what I did? I gave up income. But what I was able to do every day, and especially in my work with NPT, where the numbers got so big, was get that emotional satisfaction of satisfying this wish I had when I was 8, right? That I wanted to make the world a better place. And it manifested itself in all these ways, in all these different ways. And there's something about the people that tell me that if I was smart, I'd be in, don't understand that. It's just a foreign concept.
It makes you wonder what their primary driver is.
To be on the board even, or just in life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Both.
Yeah.
Both. We could do a whole conversation about why people serve on board, so maybe we'll save that for another time.
Yeah.
But you also said something about the hospital CEO giving people room to fail.
Yeah, I thought that was brilliant.
Actually. I think it's brilliant, but I also think it's so unusual because in this sector—
He would tell me that, too.
We are not allowed to fail because then— The vigilantes say we've wasted money, we've wasted precious resources. I hope as the next generation of leaders comes into the sector, they will have less handcuffs and more ability to experiment and get it right.
I mean, and that goes back to the override issue. How do you know if there's a better way to do something unless you've tried and failed, right? How do you know that electric lawn mowers are better than old-fashioned mowers or better than gas driven mowers? Because you like tried them and it didn't work. And you do that in the sector, you have to really be careful. And you know, everybody wants data, right? This whole thing, data-driven, evidence-based. Like, I totally get it. But if you don't have the money to get it to do that, or it's hard data to get. And because some
especially
of the stuff is
longitudinal.
Just going to say that, then what data do you use? There's this whole thing about outputs versus outcomes. You can measure outputs, but you can't outcomes easily. And so, that all spills back into this. Well, you don't really have data. You don't know what you're doing because we don't have quarterly, financials, right, that prove X or Y, right? And we don't live quarter to quarter, right? In our sector, living quarter to quarter would be nutty. What are you going to prove in a quarter of trying to solve a social problem in like a really 3 months?
Even a year.
Yeah. A year. Yeah. Exactly. So, because I studied program evaluation and I almost got my first job. And I walked in, this is true, I walked into this place and they had like this really dusty computer. Remember when computer paper was folded like this and had little green stripes on it?
The scissor paper and it had the holes on the sides.
Yeah, exactly.
The green bar paper with the holes on the
sides. It was stacked like this. And so this was a job I was interviewing for. She goes, well, you're going to be the program evaluation person. I said, yeah, that's what I studied. And she said, well, you have to go through this stack and figure out what all the data means.
Oh.
And it was like literally dust. The whole thing and the whole room was dust, and that was going to hire me.
You've been there since the dawn of time.
I said not at that moment, but I thought there's no way I'm taking that job. And it wasn't that I wasn't interested in the data. It was the daunting sense that it was in this back room that was all dirty, and this was
and nobody
what it
had
meant.
Paid attention to it. And what was the driver for them trying to fill the position then?
There was new federal mandate at the time that said if you're going to get money from HHS, you have to have data to prove it. So here's this little graduate student from
we'll jump through this
University of Michigan who said, "Oh, she I was a graduate by then, but I'm not doing that." I thought, you know what? Is you know that principle in medicine, rule out where mm-hmm. you like, I love that principle. Yeah. I explain it to people all the time. They look at me, but you know, you try things and you realize ruled out. Like, I don't want to do that. I worked in frontline mental health. I didn't want to do that. Ruled that out, ruled out the stack of paper. And then I got into politics and I thought, oh, I'm not ruling this out. You know, and then I started fundraising. I'm like, oh, I'm not going to rule this out. So you sort of by these experiences, you get to like have these things to say, okay, I really like that. I don't want to do that. I did always want to be a CEO though. I did.
Oh, interesting. That was never on my list.
Really? Why not?
I didn't want to do operations.
Oh, I actually like the operations stuff.
That's why you did. And I didn't. So we were talking about boards.
Yes.
And why I don't want to talk so much about why people volunteer to be on boards. But if you were advising someone how to think about populating a board for the next 5 years, 10 years, how do you think that's evolving, if it is?
I mean, I think, you know, I think part of the challenge is to get younger board members on, but who, I'm using the word but, which always sounds like a negative word, and who are experienced and knowledgeable enough and have a broad enough skill set that they can get on the top of the mountain. Because I think board members have to always also be on the top of the mountain with the CEO. And I'm not even sure they understand that. Because if there's somebody that are drawn to details, getting on the top of the mountain can feel like, what am I doing here? But it depends on the size of the organization. But I think I think boards are going to really need to be a mix of talent, just like they are now. Talent, age, experience, and a willingness to give time, you know, to a mission. Hopefully they're going to love the mission. I mean, you shouldn't get on a board or get on a staff, right, unless you absolutely love what the organization is doing. And so you definitely have to filter for that. But to have a mix of people, so they're, you know, so whatever you're doing in your organization, have, especially if you have a risk profile, which probably most organizations don't, but if you know that you have reputation or operational risks or risk related to finance or anything, that you should have somebody on the board relative to the things the organization's doing. So if you need some talent or help in that area, you have almost like an internal senior person there that can like have some wisdom, but know enough to know that they are not supposed to be telling you what to do, but giving you a kind of framework to how to think about it. And that's like what I just talked about. To me, that's one of the biggest issues on board, is the board sometimes doesn't know that they're not the manager.
My opinion about that, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about this. My opinion about that is it's an unusual board member who actually gets to do strategy in their day job. They typically are implementing tactics. So into the boardroom they come with skills in implementation, not skills in strategic planning or generative planning or any of that. So the lane they're traveling in their day job is the same lane as the staff. So teaching them how to get in the lane. And I think of lanes, not silos, because in silos, you can't see each other. In lanes, you can. And, you know, if somebody's in the breakdown lane, you get off and help them. Sometimes you're in the same lane. Sometimes you're in your separate lanes. But I think we don't spend enough time teaching board members the difference between strategic governance, generative governance, in operations. So
no, I think especially small organizations, I have to say, because I was with NPT when it had zero, and at the end, the kind of people that wanted to be on the board, that we could recruit to be on the board, was like night and day. You know, I mean, and so the early board was really different kind of person, and probably more like what you discussed, what you mentioned. As we got bigger, we got people that were definitely more strategic because they had more senior jobs. But but nobody trains them. Nobody trains board members. And I don't have experiences with them going to training programs where they know that it's, you know, what they call nose in, hands out, or whatever that metaphor is, that they don't know where that line is, and they don't know. And part of my job at CEO sometimes was to be that intermediary when I felt that they were telling staff people exactly how to do their jobs, was to get them to back off a little bit, because there's no way the people that are there every day working 10, we had really long hours and people worked really hard at NPT. And often, I mean, I worked every weekend, every evening, like I worked every day of the week and worked on my vacation. But my subordinates, my immediate chief people reported into me, if a board member was telling them how to do their job and they're this talented individual that we recruited, it's like they don't sit every day in the organization right. and do it. And people, I would get, people would get mad at me. I would call the board chair and I'd say, you know, so-and-so is doing this, or I would do it myself. I would call and I say, you know, we should talk about what a good way to get and have an information exchange. And right at the end, after my many years, I said to my board chair, I said, you know, I didn't do everything the board told me to do. And she said in a somewhat interesting way, I know. And I said, well, first of all, if I'm being told to do things in like completely opposing directions from different board members, turn right, turn left, go straight, go center, what I have to make a decision about what I think is best. And I, you know, so when you're, and I had enough kind of, there's a phrase, chutzpah, right, kind of guts to put that time out. And I'm sure the board members got mad at me occasionally. But my underlings didn't feel that comfortable doing that. And so I would try to kind of find a way to educate the board member at the same time and train the staff to figure out how to set those boundaries. But some people learned, some people didn't learn, some people didn't care, some people didn't know.
How big was that board?
At the end, about 14. They were all really smart, talented, really accomplished. And a lot of them were so busy, they didn't have time to do that. And they came and they, you know, they were on the investment committee, they were on the finance committee, they were on the risk, you know, the audit and risk committee. But it's really a hard part of one's job. It's really hard because we did an onboarding, but the onboarding was like who we were. You know, it was to describe the departments and the function they did and looked at the audit for the last year. But it wasn't about your general, here's your responsibilities. It was always assumed that they knew that.
And they don't.
Some
and
did.
Shame on us. Yeah.
But, some did.
But you've referenced small organizations several
really
times.
Hard. Very different.
Yeah, I think it's...
Very different. And sometimes they do want to run it. Sometimes you can just feel they want to jump
right in. Of
course.
I often think that board members who are severe with staff have experienced that in the workplace.
Yes.
And so they think this is their chance to be severe with someone else if that's happened
so
to them.
It's scary.
It is scary. But I think it's human nature kind of writ large, and we don't think about that. And as the next generation of nonprofit leaders are coming in at a very different time in the formation of the sector, because mm-hmm. I think it was still very much making its way. Fundraising as a profession was certainly making its way. It wasn't even seen as a profession. Right. The associations only just had its 60th anniversary. And of course, fundraising existed long before that. But that, when those trade associations formed, is when it was starting to get its formation really going and create a body of knowledge and look at ethics and all of those practices. But I think, in the year 75, it's going to be very different than it was in year 25.
I think it's great when board members go to training and go, if you can get them to go, but a lot of them don't have time or don't want to.
The training has to be really good.
Really good. Or you have to take the training to them.
We do, and it has to be relevant for that moment. Because I think if they learn something relevant for that moment, then they'll actually come back for more stuff that may be a little less immediate. But it's...
You have to be, I think like any learning, you have to be ready for it, right? You have to be open to it, ready for it, ready to receive it, ready to lean into it, ask questions. You can't sit there and say, like, I know all this stuff. You have to be really present. And so you need good facilitators. And it also needs to be, I think there needs to be a lot of interactive parts to it. It shouldn't just be a talking head. Right.
Yeah, you'd lose me in a moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think in my class, I do lecture, but we break up into small groups, and there's so much talent in the class. You know, we watch videos, we do all this stuff because there's learning. I mean, there's information that can come from all these different directions, including each other. And I thought, you know, I mean, I can start the framework for it, but hopefully by what they're reading and listening to. I mean, I assign videos. It's just interesting about how people learn. I think that somehow there's this notion that you're on the board, somehow you automatically know it, and it's not true.
Well, and I think that feeds back to my earlier comment. We're not allowed to admit what we don't know.
Yes.
So you confirm the assumption with silence. And hopefully that if we recruit well, I think we find that out and we give people permission, mm-hmm. even in orientation.
Well, and I think you need to have an open door, if you can, with the board members to say, you know, you might hear something and understand. If you don't want to raise your hand, write me a note. We can, you know, or like, don't hesitate and try to just be an open door, non-threatening. The donor advised fund world is pretty complicated. And so it took our board members a couple years to figure out all the things that were going on. And so that patience of those, that 2 years or whatever, was like ramping up of, you know, what are they catching on? And people who were on a committee knew what that committee was doing, but they didn't know what the other five committees were doing. Right. And so then you got the siloed knowledge. I mean, it's, you know, I've been on a university board. I was in Arcadia's board for a while. And it was not easy to, and I never worked at a university. So it was like, what's going on here? But it was a small place. It was pretty folksy, but I remember not knowing, even though I was a CEO at the time, I was on the audit committee. I thought, why did they put me on the audit committee? I actually understood audits really well because I had sat through our audit lots of times by then. And I thought, wow, I actually know this. But, which was so strange because I didn't want to take an accounting class in graduate school because I was afraid of, I might fail, I literally. But this idea of what they come in knowing and then how they learn the other things and who teaches them and how open they are. And that there's a culture of asking questions. But I think it does look to me that when they're in a group, if the staff is there especially, you don't get a lot of questions.
Well, I think the who is the most important piece, because who do they relate to? What's their structure? And it's not to go to every single staff person they want to talk to, which doesn't mean there's a firewall, but it does mean their boundaries, and there's a difference.
Right. And I mean, the other thing is that you're not their friend, but you need to have a friendly relationship
with them. Of course, absolutely, and respectful.
Yes, yes. And when they say something you don't like or agree with, you have to be really careful about how you navigate that.
So we could probably continue this conversation for another 6 hours.
Is our time up?
Well, I have one more question.
Oh,
I'd love to have your thoughts on. If I was a brand new young professional, aspiring to have a glide path of my own mission passion, but similar to yours, is there a piece of advice you'd give me?
I would probably say get your foot in the door in whatever first job you could get. And if you were interested in a donor advised fund work, especially, and be a sponge, find a mentor inside, you know, volunteer for things, pay attention to what other departments are doing. You know, if you see internal jobs that you think would be great, you know, apply for them. I had people that would always find their way sitting next to me at like lunches all these informal things about who you know, make, you know, how you have friends. I think those relationships, like just like with the donors, with your staff colleagues, are really important. Like show initiatives. I always used to do more than I was asked to do. That was one of my hallmarks. And I would do it quickly. I mean, do what you're asked to do more research, come up with things. I used to love people that came in with, when there was a problem, would come in with solutions when they would tell me what the problem was. So be a problem solver and show up all the time and work late if you have to and don't whine. But be a sponge. And if it means that you can stay, inside your organization, you can get promoted. But sometimes you can't stay in an organization and see your way to the top. You have to change. So like if you see things that would require you to like take your skills and go someplace else, you know, do it. But, don't do it every 18 months, you know. And don't feel bad. Paying your dues is really important because every job that you have gives you knowledge and information and talent and management experience, if you have it, or even watching a new manager kind of as a model, and just iteratively do that. I mean, I got really lucky because I joined this entity when it was brand new and, we didn't know, and then they made me CEO when we were still really small. I was often wondering if I could get my own job. not that I want it back, but so there's, you know, one way to get is to, you know, just go up the ladder and start applying for CEO jobs. So, and there's a lot of CEO jobs that want you to be, have already been a CEO. So if you know that about yourself, be a CEO of a smaller organization, right? And demonstrate that you have mastery over, you know, all the CEO things, and go to school and, you know, don't hesitate to like learn, ask questions. I mean, I'm a Wharton Fellow. I went to the Stanford Executive and Philanthropy Program. AFP had a one at Vanderbilt that I went to, a leadership training. They had another one in Indiana. I went to that. And I was at Abington at the time. They were all leadership training, executive skill training. I went to all that stuff. And I when work didn't pay for it, I paid for it myself.
Yeah, I think it makes a statement about the kind of person you are when you invest in yourself. And obviously it paid off.
And I just, but you know what? I got to make the world a better place. That's what paid off. Yes, that's really how I look at it. You know, and my husband says to me now, you don't have to prove anything to anybody else, but I'm writing a book and I'm teaching a second course in philanthropy at Penn now. So I'm teaching like a course and another half credit course, and I'm consulting, and I just, like, I feel like I don't want to hang my brain up on the shelf.
I don't think you idle well.
No, I don't. I'm not.
We share that, I think.
I'm not. And it's not that I'm, I do my yoga and Pilates classes, but I feel like I still have some firepower in me. And so I just am not ready to give up or like throw the towel in. On the other hand, I'm not anywhere near as busy as I used to be. And it's nice to not have scheduled mornings where I have to wake up at 5:30. So I do appreciate parts of it, but I encourage people who are drawn to the sector. It's like a calling in a way to do it and to find their way in it. And you can make a decent living. I made one and I did my 401k and I maxed out on your 401ks. The power of compounding is powerful. But I think there's something for people who need and want to do it. You know, you should do it and not be scared of it. And, you know, we had a ton of people come from the for-profit sector to work at NPT who said, oh, I'm so much more gratifying.
I think that's true. Well, thank you, Eileen Heisman, for this conversation with us.
And it's so good to see you. You were slightly elder when I came in the field, and often, just so the world knows this, Robbie would be running Flan Giving Day or Franklin Forum, and then I was right behind her. Often you were handing your, that's how I first met you. You were handing things over to me. So I was watching you right behind you. But I hope to inspire others, actually. As I think the sector's not going to go away, and we do really important work.
I don't think you have to hope. I think it's happened and happening. But thank you. Thanks so much, Eileen. So we've been enjoying a conversation with Eileen Heisman. This is part of Nonprofit Expert, presented by Donor Perfect. And thank you for sharing this time with us.
Thank you for listening to Nonprofit Expert, presented by Donor Perfect. For more information and a special offer, visit donorperfect.com/podcast.